3 for the interview with Bob Masters on the 27th of November, 1982. Testing the tape here. 1, 2, 3.
So, let's see. I've just cleared the hatch. And the first thing I noticed below me was something white, and I thought, another parachute. Maybe it's Doug, but it never entered my head that everything was happening so fast that that wouldn't have been possible. He'd be at least 2 miles astern of me. And suddenly this white thing was beside me, and I was flat on my back on the ground. It was a cow. And I had seen too many American war movies by this time, and I figured that what you do when you get to the ground and you're dragged by the chute and you spill the wind out and all these swell things, and all it did was a canopy just came down and settled on top of me. And I'm there like one of the Three Stooges trying to get out of this mess. And I thought to myself, if I had landed a half a mile further down, I'd have landed in the middle of the lake. Oh, well. The luck of the game, eh? So I gathered this thing up and stuffed it in a ditch, covered it over with weeds and brush so that it wouldn't be too evident in the daylight, and switch that off. There were maybe half a dozen cows in the field, and they all converged on me, and not being a farm kid, I didn't know whether these guys were friendly or not, but they were okay. But there was what appeared to be an orchard near this field on one side, and the opposite side was a wooded area. Nobody was around there. And I thought, well, I've got to make a move here. I've got to start going in one direction or another. And I started to go through the orchard, and there's a man with a light walking, and I thought, do I need to approach this guy, or would he be the wrong one to approach? And just after that, a German army vehicle, open car with a half a dozen troops in it, pulled up in front of those houses. So I rather guess this fellow with the light was not on my side. And there was a great deal of barking dogs. Now, I heard them for quite some time. Now, if they were using dogs, it would be not dogs that were trained to track. They'd be dogs that just to terrorize you. They use them quite a lot. Anyway, so I took off in the other direction. I fell in the ditch, which I didn't need to do because I still had my flying boots on, and they were suede, and they got wet, and they were heavy and uncomfortable. But as a side to this, as an aside, quite frequently when you bail out, the jerk from the chute opening can be sometimes as much as 10 Gs, which is enough to shake anything. The fellows have lost their watches, just go right off the end of their wrist. But the biggest fear, of course, is somebody in our position was lose your boots. And frequently, I heard afterwards of fellows that lost one or both of their boots. And knowing that this was a possibility, I know I stuck my flashlight in one of them to try and take up some of the slack. And whatever happened, the other one stayed on anyway. So I did have them. Well, I had to put a little distance between me and these people that were in all probability out looking for us, because airplanes didn't just arrive in unscheduled stops without a lot of people knowing about it. And by the time they got to where I was, they probably had already picked up my navigator, who landed right in the middle of a factory. The underground told me afterwards that They tried to get in touch with him. In fact, they did, and they tried to get him out of the factory before, as Belgian factory workers, they had access where they could get around it before the Germans showed up. And he refused to accept help from them. And subsequently, on years later, I was asked by the resistance people why I think this could have happened. And I said that, first of all, he may well have thought that he was in Germany still, in which case the last thing you wanted to do is to turn yourself over to civilians. Although I never actually mentioned this to Harold, not knowing it. I haven't spoken to him anyway. I've written to him a few times, but this I suspect to be the case, because we were not sure where we were. And that's another reason why I thought, well, do my best to evade capture as long as possible.
Can I just ask you, I think we discussed this before, if you'd had any kind of official guidance on what to do when you were shot down?
Not really. There were a few little tips. For example, obviously, strip yourself of anything that makes you look as if you're an airman. Well, you have to, all you can do is take off your military badges. If you're Welsh, anybody approaches you, speak Welsh, because they wouldn't know if it's Bulgarian or Polish or Dutch or Norwegian, and they had workers from all over, so that any foreign language, but English is recognizable. It's not too hard to detect that, even if you don't speak it. So remain silent unless you can really fool them. Just stuff like that. But as far as giving you a lead as to who to make contact with or anything like that, would be far too hazardous, even if the information were generally known, to let it out. Even, I don't suppose there were very many people in England, even in the MI services, that would have been able to pass on this information, would have even known it themselves. They used to have their own people that they could liaise with by radio, but they wouldn't have addresses and names.
Did they help you, though, in sort of, like, for example, saying, if you want to contact civilians, you're down on the ground, it's not Germany, you know it's Belgium or France, probably your best bet is, for example, to contact the local priest.
Yes, that is one thing. Just as you were asking that question, I thought to myself, yes, I do remember hearing that. The only time I approached the rectory, and this was in eastern France, and it was a bad time, it was midwinter, and we were in trouble. And we went to the rectory of a big church in a little eastern French town, and they slammed the door in our face. So you can't go by any. There's no cut-and-dried rule in this kind of a deal at all. Anyway, the fact that I got lucky in contacting these people was another one of the flukes that saw me through the war.
Tell us about it.
Well, it was the shortest night of the year. We took off on June the 21st. It was a full moon. It was virtually a cloudless sky. And it's now around 2 or 2:30 in the morning. I've got to find somewhere to become highly inconspicuous if I'm going to have another crack at this thing, get myself together a little bit. So I hiked as far as I thought to get me out of the immediate area where I'd landed. And there was a little lake surrounded by silver sand, and there was not, vegetation was relatively sparse, but there was a depression in the sand right near the shoreline. And so I laid down in there so that anybody walking down the road, which was only 100 yards away, wouldn't see me because of the sand dune affair there. I visited that place last summer, and it's called Silvermeer, which is Silver Sea or Silver Lake. And it had changed a bit, but it was an interesting visit. I'll tell you about that maybe when we get to the next phase. But the flies were, during the course of that day, just about driving me out of my mind. It But I thought, I can't go out in the middle of the day. I waited, and of course, being the shortest night of the year, I think it was around 7 o'clock in the evening. I thought, there's another 3 hours before it's dark, and then where am I going to go? Let's make a move. So I picked up, walked over to the road. I knew where it was. I had headed in from that road to the lake. So I went back out to the road, a little cobblestone road. It'd be one cart wide. And the first thing I ran into was a German soldier. Well, at the time I thought, just walk by and say nothing. And I since thought that he was probably doing the same thing. He's in a, I didn't know, mind you, at this time what country I was in. So it made a difference there, because if I were in Germany, he may have approached me and said, who are you? But since it proved out that I was in Belgium, that a soldier, a German soldier by himself, does not go up to an able-bodied man and mouth off at him, which I didn't appreciate at the time. He's as scared as I was, I'm quite sure. And we just very quietly walked by, and you don't rattle my chain, and I won't rattle yours. And it's, that part of it worked all right.
What were you wearing?
Well, it was my uniform, but I had everything cut off it. And my pants were outside my flying boots. But I think anybody with a half a brain could have seen I was an airman. That just the look on my face must have... there was a little old lady and a boy with a bit of a wood cart affair. They were picking up faggots, I guess, just like Hansel and Gretel. And I went up to approach them, and I thought, well, they won't understand anything. They don't look like the college graduate type of situation that you get multilingual people, although there's a tremendous amount of it over there. So I carried on, not a couple of hundred yards, and there was a little brick square two-story building, and it was a pub. You could tell from the little sign on it, but it wasn't sort of a little tiny windows in it. It was a very peculiar-looking place for a public house, cafe. But there were, half a dozen bicycles out in the front. So I thought, well, now or never. We'll find out where I am and who I am and all the rest of it. Well, I walked in the door, and the reception I got was unique. Well, women were kissing me, and men were slapping me on the back and shaking my hand, and I figured, well, I must be in occupied territory. This was the first thing that really bothered me, because you could get pretty badly messed up. A lot of fellows did. In Germany by civilians, particularly in the target areas where the night of our raid, one crew was strung up to lampposts right in the middle of the city, so that's not very nice, really. I understand a couple of people got run off the end of the dock into the River Thames in the fog. Could be. Anyhow, these people were certainly on our side, and one fellow came up and spoke English. He's an ex-sailor. He'd been all over the world, and fell about in his early 30s. And his English was really very good, idiomatic even. And he said, come on, we got to get you out of here. And he ran me out through the back and hid me in between a couple of rows of peas, which are good hiding because they're close enough together. You had to be right in line with a fellow to see it. And the garden was surrounded by brambles on the far side of the fence, so it was secure as far as visual spotting was concerned, but, of course, not everybody was known to be in the resistance in that cafe. So the exposure I had there had to be minimal, and they had to get me out of there. So he brought me a big chunk of bread and a glass of the blackest beer I ever saw in my life. Well, I hadn't had anything to eat for 24 hours, and the beer was good, but it was so strong and a bit sweet, I can recall. And I couldn't get more than about an inch down on the glass, and that was all I needed, and I couldn't eat the bread. I just wasn't into it. So he came back in a few minutes. He said, okay, I got it all set. You're to go over the fence down to the bank of the canal, which is within sight. He said, wait there, and I'll pick you up on a bicycle in about 5 minutes. Well, I didn't get over the fence fast enough, and he gave me the old horse mounting trick with my foot in his hands, and he just upended me over this into the brambles, and I was worried about getting caught in the barbed wire. But I survived that part of it, but it impressed on me the fact that these people were pretty serious about all this stuff, and maybe I should try to do the best I can to go along with what they need, because it was what I needed. Well, normally speaking, on ops, as air crew, we didn't carry sidearms. We had our choice. And I think most of us felt the same way. Why carry a sidearm when all it can do is succeed and get you into real trouble? If you get shot down, particularly in Germany, you know where you're going to, 6 rounds, you're going to shoot yourself out of Germany. It's just an absolute display of arrogance, and who needs it? So I didn't have a sidearm. I never met a guy, never saw one on the squadron ever that carried one either. But this chap that came with a bicycle a few minutes later, I mounted the back of his bicycle on a carrier with a half-inflated tire riding over the Belgian cobbles. It was an experience. In any case, he asked me a little bit down the canal bank if I had a revolver, and I said, no, I didn't. No, he says, that's too bad. He said, there's a intersection up here with a little locks, and he says, there's a German guard there, and we might as well shoot him. And I thought, this guy, is he real? And I said, well, no, I'm sorry, I haven't got that. He said, okay, then you'll have to hide in the bushes here, and I'll see what's going on, and I'll come back and get you in a few minutes. And we found our way around that particular intersection where the German guard was. But I thought, that's a great way to start the war, go in there and shoot somebody and not even know the language or where you are or who you are or anything else. And all it does is aggravate them, and then they take reprisals. And I often wondered at these resistance people. Some of the most active ones, I'm sure, were mad. You had to be to succeed. Anyhow, we went to a little factory. It was a glass factory where they made crystal baubles, glasses, stuff like that. And we were in the heart of the glass-making area in Belgium.
Is this northern Belgium, southern Belgium?
Northeastern Belgium. The village, closest village, was Mol, spelled M-O-L. It's not a very big place, and it's within cycling distance of Turnhout, which is to the north of Mol, and due east of Antwerp. Anyhow, I met the old watchman there, and I gave him the last of my cigarettes. I used to smoke in those days. And then afterwards, I regretted it because I thought, well, you know, probably get one somewhere, but maybe it was a good time to quit. Anyhow, they stuck me up in the loft of a windmill. And I waited there all day, and I sneaked a few peeks out of a window. I could see a German soldier, all in uniform, but out on the stream bank fishing. I don't know if he caught anything or not. And then around mid-afternoon, a fellow that I knew as Louis, had met him once, arrived back with another fellow on bicycles, and the other chap disappeared, found his own way home, and they gave me the spare bike, and Louis and I cycled into the village of Mol, and this is where he lived with his parents. And we had a very interesting evening that night. The man was this young Louis. He was the same age as myself, 21. He had a play produced, or I should say an operetta produced, a year after the date that I met him. It opened in Turnhout, and he was taken by the Gestapo the next day. I never did hear what happened to his play, but he played some original compositions that night. Delightful. He was most remarkable, as I say, but I think he was mad. He used to like this business of going around with a hand grenade in each pocket. And he had some idea at the time that he wanted to blow up one of the army shows for the German soldiers, where they'd have the whole place loaded with German army, and just roll a grenade down each aisle at the same time, something like that. Well, I wasn't too interested in this. It was too big a step for me. I wasn't ready for it. I couldn't quite handle that. I declined the offer. And I told him, I said, all you do is wind up getting the whole village wiped out anyway. So maybe he was only testing me, I don't know. Because he didn't do that particular trick, although he was pretty active in the underground. I did hear after that he had been captured. I didn't know the details of it. This was after the war, and that he'd wound up in Dachau, and that his girlfriend, who was there at the same time, I had met her, Mariette Dumoulin. She was taken at the same time, went to Ravensbrück, the female extermination camp. Louis's father was taken, and another chap that I knew at this same time, by the name of Fruithof, he was taken, and Mariette's father. And the only one I knew for sure after the war that had survived the camps was Mariette, and that she was spent several years in hospitals, in and out of hospitals. She'd be in for 6 months, and they'd let her out for a month or two, and then they'd have other operations. They broke her legs, and they broke her arms, and all sorts of things. What I didn't know at the time was that these people had been arrested through information gained through an informer who had witnessed specifically my involvement with these people in June of 43, although they were taken in March of 44, and that they were looking for me in particular, a thing I only learned this last summer. 41 years later, I found out that the Gestapo was looking for me, or the SS, and it was a bit of a sobering awakening, I can assure you. It shook me. Anyhow, I don't know where to fit in the part of the informer on that, whether it should be now or at the end.
Well, why don't you, we've talked about the informer, why don't you tell us?
Okay, well, I had heard at the end of the war that these people were under the impression that I had been taken at Antwerp, which would have been a matter of a few days after I left them. And this, of course, was not the case, because I was over 6 months before I was taken, and then we were trying to get into Switzerland, so there was no connection whatever. But somewhere along the line, in the subsequent years, it came to me that there might have been some doubt as to whether I was the person that blew the whistle on this group, and I didn't feel very happy about that, because it hadn't been the case. And so I explained this last summer when I went back to see these people. And I didn't know who had survived. And the chap, Louis, was using his Belgian, or his Flemish name, Ludo. And people referred to Ludo and said that he knew me, and I must remember him, and this sort of thing. And, of course, I said, the man you described sounds somewhat like the Louis I knew, except you say that this chap is such a peaceful, easygoing soul. And I said, I didn't think that the guy I knew had a prayer of ever seeing the end of the war because he was too radical. And that I had heard that he'd been taken by the Gestapo and turned over to the SS in one of the camps, and that Mariette had, of course, was the name of the girl that he was engaged to at that time. It wasn't until 2 days before I was due to go up to this village of Mall that I was really able to put my finger on this whole thing because of an eye injury that Louis had had prior to my meeting him. And I happened to mention this, and the chap that had sponsored my visit, or I guess sponsored my visit in a sense, to Belgium this time and organized the meeting with all these people for me, had said, well, he knew this eye injury, but he thought it had happened during the war, and I wouldn't have known about it. And I said, no, it happened before. And so that in this way, the first time I ever knew that Louis and Ludo were the same man, and that he had, in fact, survived the war. So I had a bit of a job explaining to him when I met him this summer that why I didn't go and see him in 1960. That wasn't easy to do. And then I thought, well, the man's a realist. So I said, Ludo, I thought you were dead. And he said, well, I can understand that. He was realistic, as I say. But we got on to this business of the Antwerp arrest. And I said, you know, that's not where I was taken. And I said, I don't want anybody to ever be under the misapprehension that I was responsible for informing on you people. And he said, we know who did it. Don't worry about it. And it never crossed our minds that it was you in any case. Whoever you got that from was strictly in error. And he said, what happened was that, if you recall, there was a girl standing or a woman standing in the garden at Fruithof's when Mariette and you and I cycled from Mall to Turnhout. We stopped to talk to Fruithof, who was a member of his, Louis, or Ludo's five-man cell, resistance cell. And I said, well, I remember somebody there, but I don't remember anything about her. And he said, well, that was Geraldine. Now, Geraldine had a baby by an illegitimate baby by a German officer, and the Germans were using this as a lever on the girl to obtain information from anybody that she knew, and they were almost sure that Fruithof and one or two of his friends were involved in resistance undertakings. And she was a nurse. What her connection with Fruithof was, or I couldn't say, but at any rate, she was there, and she knew who I was. She knew my name, certainly. And that eventually they pressured her enough so that she was the one who informed. And as a result, they were looking for me as well as these people. And that has two sides to it. The first one is that there are ways of getting messages out of places like Dachau. And Louis and or Fruithof, one of these people, got a message out, a letter out, that was laid out in format in such a way that each line of the letter began with a successive letter of the name Geraldine, so that all one had to do was read vertically down the left-hand page and the message was there. And Geraldine was dealt with summarily. And they didn't mess around. I mean, they do away with people like that, and it's unfortunate that a person should be put in that terrible position. But you can't escape a war when it's on to you like that, and that's one of the things we mentioned before. Where is the justice in it? That is, I don't think there is any. Anyway, Geraldine was no longer with us. So he said, don't feel that you had anything to do with it. But he said, you might be interested to know, and here's side two to this thing, which this is in 1982 we're talking about now, and Ludo and I had a bit to fill in on because I hadn't seen him for some time and I thought he was dead, as I said. But he said, we were taken in March of 1944. He said, you say you were taken in the 23rd of December, 43. He said, they were looking for you, and they had you, and they didn't know it. And our police commissioner friend, Marius Lusch, who arranged all these meetings for me, said, with the computer system today, they would have had you in 12 minutes, physically, never mind on record. But he said, chances are that somebody along the line assumed that you'd made it back to England because you hadn't surfaced for such a long time, and that for whatever reason, never bothered to go to the records of Dulagluft, where I would have normally wound up, and where, in fact, I probably was at the very time these people were taken, and that I would have had the resistance treatment, too, which would have been the extermination camps. Not just a concentration camp, there's a difference. The extermination camps were the you went there for that one purpose. The other ones were had work commandos or work parties where they went out and worked on farms and stuff like that, as did some of our military people. But the, normally speaking, the concentration work commandos were mines where you can't get out too easily, factories which are secure from an escape point of view, and whereas farm work was considered to be pretty good stuff. Nice and easy, extra grub, but not for those people. But those are concentration camps. The extermination camps are the ones that you have seen pictures of in the newsreels right after the war, where the corpses are lined up like cordwood and great mass pits and that sort of stuff. So, as I say, that rather shook me a little bit, because I hadn't quite appreciated that once I was safe in a POW camp, where it was all military, that I had it made as far as being related to the resistance in any way. And I had 6 months to account for, and I had a lot of names. And anybody who says they could withhold information is an idiot, a naive idiot. You'd have to be as mad as they are to withstand it. You just process yourself immediately. I don't know how successful anybody ever was at this. The only people that ever survived these interrogations are those who genuinely didn't know anything, and the interrogators might have just thought, well, maybe he's right. Anybody who knows anything could never have stood what we've given this guy now, so he's got to be clean. Throw him out in the street or do what you need to. They did this on a routine basis as well. They used to cordon off one section of a street and say, okay, everybody in the street, throw them in the slammer. We got one block of cells just right for this length of the street. Let them stew in there for about a month and then pull them out one at a time and interrogate them and really scare hell out of them, which isn't hard to do to somebody who's really just a little quiet citizen trying to survive in amongst all this nonsense, who's not involved at all. And after doing this with thousands of people, they get pretty canny at who is and who isn't involved in any sort of contraband business. And if they get even the slightest inkling that you're involved or one is involved in something like this, then they'll clean out the rest of the street or release them. Say, okay, you guys go home. And they'll have maybe a half a dozen people, and then they'll really start working them over. Now, this Willie Stenchen here, they picked him up, this other half of that one, and they put him through the hoop.
Was he a member of the group that you...
Well, they didn't connect him with me. Now, what other things he did in the underground, I couldn't really say for sure. I don't think he was too active. He was just a trusted member of the community where an airman could be hidden safely. But an airman or any evading Allied soldier was an automatic death penalty, and the Gestapo never had to account to anybody because you shot too many people, no big deal. If you didn't shoot enough, you could be held accountable. Why is it that this man got away? That was their attitude. So that if at any time the Gestapo had walked in the door and found me in that house, they would have wiped us all out. They wouldn't. There would. It's not worth the hassle, to, unless they thought that there was a real connection, that there was a chance of tracing out a lot of people. They wouldn't bother to save anybody. Just write them all off. I at one point was heading out to go back to England, and there was a trail that we used, a safe path.
This is from where you are in Belgium.
This is later. I'm hopping around here a little bit, but to give you an example, though, I got down to the Belgian border, and somebody had phoned ahead and said, "Stop them." The party that had gone through this same route, underground railway, ahead of me, had all been gunned down on the platform of the Gare du Nord in Paris. Couriers and 5 American airmen. And they don't even care who else is getting off the train. I mean, there's their guys, and bam, they let them have it, and that's it. It had its moments of unpleasantness attached to the whole scene. And so that's one of the reasons why I came back, and I was so long in Belgium, was the fact that the lines were closing up. They were sending through Gestapo agents, and they had lots of them that had been raised in the United States. The German-American Bund was pretty popular over there, because there were a lot of German nationals and people that had first-generation Germans who were still very German, regardless of who was in it, and they hadn't seen any real evils in what Hitler was doing up until the war began. And between 33 and 39, the Germans were offering reduced passages or one-way passages free and return passages for the price of a one-way ticket. You know, they didn't lose a dime on that. For people that wanted to come back to the fatherland and visit, and I don't know what the real reason they said was that you should come back, but these people grabbed the chance. And if they were German nationals, they weren't American citizens, they went straight to the army camp. You're in the army. And that was it. And I ran into 2 or 3 of them.
Were they fed into the escape route? Is that what you're saying?
Some of these guys were. The ones that were enthusiastic. Some people got stuck in the army because they thought, well, I've been skinned. Look at me. What did I do coming back here? I should be having my head examined. They should have. But they were greedy. And one of the fellows tripped his hand. And he said to me, I wouldn't come back again if they offered me the whole of Germany, or the whole of Europe. I said, how much did they offer you? Well, he didn't want to talk about that then. But they had a pretty nice offer going for them. Come on back and join the new, you know, the new master race and the Third Reich and the whole thing. So they had ample reserves of native-speaking Americans who spoke German and English as a primary tongue in both cases. Well, they could slip those, and knew the United States, had grown up there, and they could slip them through along with other airmen and say, I come from Cincinnati. I went to high school at wherever. He might even meet one of these people for all it would make any difference, and they'd say, sure, I knew him. What a coincidence. But so it wasn't hard to slip a Gestapo agent into the system. But the cell system that I referred to is the structure of the organization of the resistance group that I was first connected with. Because I was with a terrorist group for a while, too.
What was the resistance group that you first made contact with, that Louis was attached to?
Yeah.
Did this group have a name? Was it have
no.
any kind of...
Nobody had names.
Was it any kind of affiliated... I mean, was it a political group?
No,
or
strictly resistance to the one aim of this group was to get Germany back out of their country. That's all. And they'd do anything they had to do it, whether it was blowing up a dike or flooding a field or draining a canal so that they could stop the barges from going through, just anything. It didn't matter. And But it was a sophisticated group, in spite of the fact the impression I got that Louis was a little bit half-baked. Maybe he wasn't half-baked as much as I thought he was. Anyhow, and maybe that is, now that I think of it, it was his real name in French, but he always went by Ludo, but I didn't know that. And I did know other people by their right name, some by a fake name. And by the time you got so mixed up with a set pattern of Bob, Jim, James, all the common names, and you don't, and you couldn't tell one guy from another from a point of view of identification with regard to names. But the cell structure, there were a series of groups throughout the area that they operated in, five-man teams, and one man in that team only knew anybody else in any other team. Now, the teams themselves had to know one another in the five-man group because they had to work together. There's no such thing as a single operator. That can't happen. But if you're going to set up a sabotage or anything like that, you need lookouts and all the rest of it. But they found that a five-man team was ideal from a point of view of tactical expediency. Now, the cell leaders would know four other men, and they would know one other man above them, and there would be 10 cell leaders. And of those 10 cell leaders, one would be their chief liaison. But the cell leaders did not know one another. So that if Jerry wanted to break into a cell, he had to you catch anyone from that cell, and it stops there. Except if they catch the leader. And they've got to know that they got the leader. They don't even really know for sure if this is the cell structure. They don't know an awful lot. Because the Belgians didn't know. Okay, so you got lucky and you caught a cell leader. Well, he can only tell you one man. He can't tell you 10 cell leaders. Sure, theoretically, it could be broken. But you got to know it exists before you can break it. And then there was an executive lived in Brussels. And I only heard in a kind of a rumor way that there were something like four or five people in the executive. And they, of course, they organized and held the thread together. They had facilities to communicate with people in Britain. But I don't know for sure any more than that. The fact that the structure was so effective that if people in the cell that I happened to be working in wanted to tell me any more, they wouldn't know it anyway. And somewhere or other, I dropped out of that system, and I don't know where that was.
What, the people in this cell, were they all men?
Not necessarily. Mariette was a member.
Okay.
Louis was a member.
Right.
Fruithof and the two old men.